Is our vaccination rate building fast enough to ward off the Delta variant? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, July 13th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome South Dakota's Secretary of the Department of Health, Kim Malsom-Risden, talks with us about the uptick in COVID cases, particularly in West River counties, what needs to be done to prevent further spread. We look at advancements in vitro fertilization with a reproductive specialist. We head to the ranch to hear from Wayne Frederick and Rosebud. State historian Ben Jones is with us to explore the destruction of the American bison. Plus, some people visit our national parks and say, meh, I'm not impressed. Subpar Parks is coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio at SDPB's Sioux Falls Studios. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. The 2020 presidential election got some attention on Monday at the annual Sioux Falls Rotary Club meeting. Joel Dykstra, who is Rotarian of the Year, asked South Dakota's long U.S. congressman about the election. Representative Dusty Johnson says possible voting irregularities should not discredit the results.
You don't have to like the decisions they make. But we can't just view every loss as evidence of corruption. And so I'm going to be dedicated to improving election integrity. At the same time, I'm going to try to talk about these issues in a responsible way and not try to claim that elections were stolen, because they weren't.
Johnson says the 2020 election had inconsistencies that need to be addressed in each individual state. South Dakota abortions plummeted to a record low in 2020. The 125 abortions represented a 67% decrease from the previous record set in 2018. The massive decline was due to COVID-19's impact on the state's sole elective abortion provider. SDPB's Arielle Zions has more.
Abortion has been declining across the country for decades, and numbers have been especially low in South Dakota due to strict laws and the fact that there's only one provider. But 2020 saw an extreme decline due to the pandemic. Planned Parenthood in Sioux Falls decided in late March that it was too risky for its out-of-state doctors to travel for the procedure. So there were just 125 abortions last year. There were zero between April through June, and three between July and September. Those would have occurred at hospitals for medical reasons, since Planned Parenthood didn't restart abortions until October. Dr. Sarah Traxler is the chief medical officer for the clinic in Sioux Falls and surrounding states.
It was actually pretty devastating not to be able to be available for our patients in South Dakota the way that we had been before. But we had systems in place to help get patients to other places outside of South Dakota.
Some South Dakotans had to drive more than 5 hours for the procedure. Advocates say that means women may have to take time off work while paying for travel, childcare, and lodging. Planned Parenthood and nonprofits were able to help some of these women with cost and logistics. For SDPB, I'm Arielle Zions in Rapid City.
The International Dark Sky Association works to preserve views of the night sky and fight light pollution. Light pollution is created primarily by signage, businesses, street lamps, and residential homes. Diane Knutson is the president of the board of directors for the association. She says it's a growing concern.
It's increasing faster than the human population at 2% every year. And not just intensity, but also the boundary is widening. So you only have in the United States about 8 natural night places left.
Knutson says dark skies are important for healthy ecosystems.
There are over 250,000 birds a day that are getting lost in their migration or light pollution patterns because they navigate by starlight at night. They get pulled into city areas. They circle buildings that are illuminated, can't find their star pattern to get back out and continue their travels.
Knutson says cities can put lights on dimmers and motion sensors to help. Instead of blue and white lights that mimic daytime, amber red lights are a better option. Go to darksky.org for more information. Today's weather report shows highs in the mid to upper 80s across the state and lows in the 60s. There's a 90% chance of severe thunderstorms tonight. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Nick Tilson is the leader of NDN Collective. That's a Rapid City-based nonprofit dedicated to building Indigenous power. He and others used their bodies and disabled vehicles to shut down the road to Mount Rushmore when former President Donald Trump was speaking on July 3rd of 2020. The National Guard used force to move the group off the road, and Tilson and 19 others were arrested. Tilson was facing more than 16 years in prison after being charged with 7 crimes. We haven't had any updates since Tilson began a diversion program in March until his team recently filed documents asking a judge to dismiss the charges. SDPB's Ariel Zients joins me now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Rapid City studio with an update. Ariel, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the diversion program Tilson was a part of.
Sure. So diversion is meant to prevent people from re-entering the criminal justice system. The idea is that you want to end this cycle of re-entering. And this is often for people who kind of have root cause issues with crimes, so drug addiction, mental health issues. That's not really the case here, but you can still be part of it. And how it works is if you complete the program, which is often community service, maybe, you know, counseling if it is a drug and mental health issue, and then if you're not arrested for a year after, your entire case and the arrest is dropped and expunged. And what was offered to Tilson is if he would admit to one of the charges, which is simple assault against a National Guard, and he would do that within the diversion program through writing, not in open court. In exchange, prosecutors would drop all other charges against him and the other protesters. So that was his deal.
All right. So what happened with the diversion program? Take us forward then.
Sure. So he submitted a factual basis for that simple assault. And it's important to note that he was not accused of assaulting anyone. There's a South Dakota, I guess, sub-law within that, where basically it's you're putting someone in fear of bodily harm. And he says he acknowledged how she felt, and he cited that her testimony during a hearing. And he was on video stealing a shield from her as they were pushing in a row towards him and others. He met with Marty Cross, the head of diversion. He says it went really well. They selected a community service the element for that. And what's interesting is that he told me that he specifically asked Marty, will this program, will it impact my right to talk about my work, but it's specifically this case?
He said, Mr. Tilson, me and you might not agree politically on a whole lot of things, but those are rights that you have that are protected. And you being in this diversion program in any way, shape, or form doesn't limit your rights.
And this conversation that he says happened is key to why he's asking for the charges to be dropped, as you'll see. So this was on March 22nd of this year. So the same day he had this meeting, he starts talking about the deal because he says he was told he's allowed to. And he says Indian Collective won. He talks about how he believes the case was racially and politically motivated. And after that, things go silent. We don't hear anything from him. We don't hear anything from the prosecutor, Mark Fargo. I keep checking the court records. There's nothing.
All right. So what have we learned happened after that intake meeting?
Sure. So he held a press conference where he announces he's filing a motion to dismiss. And he's accusing Fargo of prosecutorial misconduct, violating his First Amendment, and his right to a speedy trial. And so basically why he's alleging these things is outlined in some documents, some emails that were attached to his motion. And we don't have any comments or documents from the prosecutors yet, so it may not be a complete picture. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that, so 2 days after the intake, which was the same day he started speaking out about how this was a victory, Fargo sends an email to Tilson's team saying, you need to make video apologies to the officer you admit to assaulting in that way we talked about, but also to the other officer, which, again, that charge was dropped. And then he also has to write a letter to the sheriff apologizing and then an open letter to all law enforcement. Tilson is totally surprised by this. He says this is the first time he's ever seen any request for these apologies. And he views this as retaliation. Okay, because I spoke out, you're now asking for these new elements. And he argues that this is what the case is about, trying to silence his voice and Indian Collective's voice.
We had a deal. An agreement was made. I fulfilled my end of the agreement. He didn't like my tone, so now he wants to pull back on the whole thing.
And then what we see in the documents is that Tilson's lawyer responds to Vargo, making similar points to what Tilson told me. But he says Tilson still wants to do the diversion program. He offers to meet with the sheriff instead of doing these apologies. So Vargo then responds to that email saying, okay, let me run this by the sheriff and you will hear back from me. So again, that was March 29th. Tilson told me that him and his team don't hear anything back from Vargo until recently, until June 28th, which is when they receive a letter, which is, again, we can see this in the file, saying that, okay, we need to go back to court since diversion failed. And his team is kind of like, what? It didn't fail. I've been doing the volunteering. We want to resolve this. So in response to that, that is why he filed this motion to dismiss. But with him filing this motion and the email from the prosecution, basically diversion is over. This is either going to be dismissed if a judge agrees with Tilson, or it's going to end in a trial and a plea deal. And Tilson talked about that, you know, if this does go to trial, it's not just going to be about him. He says all Native American families in the area have a bad experience with police or the criminal justice system.
If we go to trial, this is going to be a trial about the system. A trial about a system that is perpetuating inequity in this community. And we want to dismantle that because we actually want to believe and fight for a world where there's equity and justice for all people in Mother Earth.
All right, so tell us what Mark Vargo, who is the Pennington County State's Attorney, has to say in response to all of this.
Sure. So Vargo declined to comment. His policy is not to comment on open cases, but we do get to see some of his views in that letter to Tilson's lawyer, and we'll be finding out more about what he makes of this motion once he files his response. But basically, his argument is part of diversion is that you have to accept, quote, that or what you did was, quote, criminal and inappropriate. And he says Tilson has not admitted to that. And that part is complicated. So Tilson did sign a factual basis with that one charge, but he's also arguing that he's committed no crime and did nothing wrong. You know, he says that grabbing the shield was self-defense, you know, literally in the moment was self-defense. He was being pushed against, so he pulled back. But also that, you know, he thinks that you can't commit a crime as a Lakota person in this area because of jurisdiction related to the Black Hills Treaty that was broken. So, we will wait to see how Vargo responds in motions and briefs, and then also what a judge makes of it eventually.
SDPB's Ariel Zients continues to follow this case. You can go on our website at sdpb.org and see some of those documents Ariel has been talking about. Thanks for joining us today with the update.
Thank you.
After the break, we look at in vitro fertilization and how it has changed drastically over the years. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Sure, you might want to go to college, but what are you going to study?
My mom had a degree in sociology. My dad, I think, had a degree in political science. That was like my template.
I'm Kai Rizdahl talking career paths and parental footsteps. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center and Pier. Now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
Sometimes just this simple. Sometimes life is just this simple. Sometimes life is really just this simple. I love my dog.
We answer complex philosophical questions each week. I'm Larry Gross. It's Mountain Stage, live performance radio from NPR.
Listen Saturday evening at 6, 5 Mountain, and Sundays at noon, 11 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council. Presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Assisted reproductive technology has changed significantly in recent years. Dr. Keith Hansen is a reproductive medicine specialist at Sanford Health, and he's joining us today to talk about understanding new technology and how it helps families conceive. Dr. Hansen, welcome. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
This is a scientific conversation, but it's also a sensitive conversation for many families because of the nature of infertility. So before we get started on sort of what's changed in the research and scientific advancements, tell me a little bit about your experience with working with women trying to conceive and how it can be a really emotional journey.
Well, thank you for that question. Yes, it is. It can be quite an emotional journey, and I think it's one where people feel like they may be, you know, traveling the journey alone. But, you know, in reality, somewhere between 10 to 15% of all reproductive age couples go through infertility at some time in their life, either be that primary infertility where they never get pregnant or secondary infertility where they get pregnant and then have trouble in the future getting pregnant. And, you know, one of the problems or one of the issues that occurs, of course, is, you know, the fact that all the medications that we use are really increase the amount of hormones that the ovaries are making and really sort of, you know, prime everything. And then once those levels get up really high, then if the person doesn't get pregnant, then those levels fall precipitously. And so it's kind of like a roller coaster of hormones, which then also can cause a roller coaster of emotions, including, you know, if the person is not pregnant, of course, that's quite a emotional state, especially when you've went through all the different medications and all the different interventions that occur to try to help them conceive.
Yeah. So let's talk through some of the changes, because I think when I talk to other people about in vitro fertilization, I hear a lot of octomom, test tube baby, you know, looking back at some things that they remember from the 80s, you know, for example, news stories that grabbed headlines. We're living in a different world today, aren't we?
Yes. And, you know, even at the time of octomom, we were... there was also limits on the number of embryos that one was supposed to replace. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine has, for a long time, had guidelines on how many embryos to put in. And now, over time, because our pregnancy rates have improved, the number of embryos that we put in has been significantly reduced. But even at the time of Octomom, the person who transferred those embryos transferred way too many. In that situation, they put in six embryos, and two of those subsequently divided to give, you know, Octomom. And at that time, you know, here we would have probably put in one or two embryos. We would not have ever considered putting in six. And that's how most reproductive endocrinologists are in the United States and even in the world, is they follow those guidelines really well. So I guess the things that have changed, you know, one of the things have been, you know, improvements in the in getting, you know, better embryos so that we can reduce the number we put in. So the risk of having multiple babies has is significantly reduced. And as I mentioned, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has really helped us to, using all the national data, to tell us how many is the best number to put in to give the absolute best chance of having a live baby to take home. So that's one of the big advancements. Another one is the treatment of male factor has taken a significant improvement with something called ICSI, which is intracytoplasmic sperm injection. We now have the ability in males who have very, very low sperm counts, or even if they have no sperm, if we can get sperm out of the testicle or out of the epididymis, we can actually do in vitro fertilization, and our lab guys can go in, find a normal sperm, and pick it up and inject it into the egg. So that's another big advance that's occurred in vitro fertilization. And then another advance, and there's more, I'm just three of the big ones I'm thinking about are that we now can, you know, we can actually biopsy the embryos when they're at day five of development, and we can tell if an embryo has a disease such as cystic fibrosis or spinal muscular atrophy or one of these other really serious genetic illnesses before we put the embryo in.
Will you define embryo for our listeners who are a little unclear, you know, fertilized egg, embryo, fetus? Give us some definitions, some medical definitions, please.
Well, you know, an egg is the gamete that's produced by, is an unfertilized gamete produced by the ovary. The sperm is an unfertilized gamete produced by the testicle. And when they come together, you get an a fertilized egg or a zygote, which then undergoes a process of division. And, you know, most people consider once it undergoes a division, then it becomes, embryo. And then the embryo reaches a cleavage stage, which is from the time of when it starts to cleave till it, till it's born. Then it goes from the, you know, when it's like a, we usually consider cleavage stage embryos, usually by about day three, the embryo has somewhere around 6 to 8 cells. And then it undergoes the development into a morula, which is a round ball of cells. And then that starts to, hollow out and become a blastocyst. It has, and at day five, you can, or six, sometimes it takes a little bit longer, but you can actually tell because there's the outer part of the basketball or the blastocyst. It's just kind of like a basketball with a lump over it with one side, a lot smaller than a basketball though.
Right.
The outer part is the trophectoderm, and that's what goes to form the placenta and the membranes, and then the inner part is the inner cell mass, and that's what goes on to form the embryo and ultimately the fetus and the baby.
Okay, that was super interesting. Thank you for that.
You know,
we reduce these things down to certain definitions. So for people, for families, you know, for women who are trying to conceive, I should say it's super interesting if it's not happening to you and it's part of this, you know, emotional journey or this physical journey that you're taking. So I want to bring that back to where we began with. Hope, you offer a hope for success in a way that you couldn't offer 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Help put that in perspective before we let you go.
Oh, sure. You know, back like when we first started doing in vitro fertilization, you know, the pregnancy rate was very, very small. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when you'd get a pregnancy, you'd call your friends to tell them, hey, I got a pregnancy. You know, now the pregnancy rate has improved significantly. I mean, like one advantage we have is the CDC has a web page that gives the assisted reproductive technology reports for every year, and we're one of the it's groups that are part of the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technologies. We always report all of our data to SART, and then they give it to the CDC, and the CDC puts it out in a generalized format, so you can get a national summary of the data throughout the entire country, and then you can actually go on the website and look up specific clinics and find out what is their pregnancy rate and how many retrievals do they do and all that kind of stuff. And for the last date that's currently on the website, the national, for a woman under 35, the pregnancy rate was about 52% for, you know, women who started the stimulation and wanted to do an egg retrieval. Below the age of 35, the pregnancy rate was 52% of having a live-born baby. So that was, you know, so that means the pregnancy rate with, you know, including miscarriages was higher than that. But, and then as a woman ages, the pregnancy rate goes down.
Sure.
But we do have, you know, the CDC data is freely available to any person that has a computer. They can look it up and see what the data is throughout the country.
So fascinating. This is part of an ongoing series we're going to do on In the Moment about women's health issues that maybe we don't fully understand, even though sometimes we think we do. Dr. Keith Hansen, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate your time. Hope to talk to you again in the future.
Well, thank you. It was nice talking to you, and thanks for letting me chat a little bit.
Up next, more healthcare coverage. South Dakota Secretary of Health Kim Malsom-Risen is with us for an update on vaccination efforts in South Dakota. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
There are more than 1.5 million biographies on the English language version of Wikipedia, but fewer than 19% of them are about women.
I think it really complicates our understanding of how women's contributions to society are assessed.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A new study on gender bias on Wikipedia this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by First Dakota National Bank. Every timeless institution, tradition, and thriving business was started somewhere by someone who had a dream. Here's to those who made it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Stay up to date with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Sign up for newsletters from SDPB. You can learn more about what's happening at our studios, get encapsulated news, see previews of specials, and so much more. SDPB in your inbox. Sign up online at sdpb.org.
Program funding by MidGo Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at midgo.com/business.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. More than 57% of South Dakotans have received at least their first dose of a COVID vaccine. How is the Delta variant impacting our unvaccinated population? Kim Malsom-Risen is the state's Secretary of the Department of Health, and she's joining us now for an update on the battle against COVID. Secretary Malsom-Risen, appreciate your time. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Let's start with the vaccines and the good news as this continues to progress. What can you tell us by way of update?
Well, vaccine remains readily available across the state, and I want to just make sure people understand that it's available at no cost, and some people have had questions about that, but you know, we get the vaccine from the federal government at no cost, and we've got support to help get shots in arms. And so people shouldn't worry about that. You know, you can go to covid.sd.gov, find, you know, various places to become vaccinated in the community. We've really seen, you know, a great increase in access points. And we're going to continue to work on this through the summer and into the fall. We really want to get to 70% of the population being vaccinated. And, you know, we've got about, like as you mentioned, about 57% of the population over age 12 vaccinated at this point. When you look at folks that are 18 and older, we've got about 64% of that group. So we've got a little work to do. And, you know, we just want to, we want people to keep an open mind, keep looking for information about it, and, you know, hopefully choose to become vaccinated.
Let's talk about those access points, because when Dr. Shankar Kaur from Monument Health was on the last time, he said, you know, yes, it's true that some people are, you know, deciding not to get this for reasons that, you know, they have made choices of their own. But largely the next push is really to look at increasing access points and making it easy for people in rural areas to get the shot with minimal disruption to their work lives or their personal lives. Do you concur with that? What is the push toward access at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when we think about how people just generally access healthcare, the ways you can make vaccinations most convenient is to couple it with things that people are already doing. So if you're going to a pharmacy, let's say, for other reasons, and it's easy to get a shot there, you know, we've seen a great increase in pharmacies across the state having vaccine available. The other thing that we've seen as we've seen more supply come into being is the ability for people to get shots at their doctor's office. And I know, you know, as a patient myself, you know, when I go to the doctor for other things and they review my vaccination, you know, record and say, hey, you know, you're up for whatever vaccine. It's just an easy way to get it done. And so that's what's happening with COVID as well. And that's just a convenient way for people to, you know, go ahead and get their vaccine.
Right. So as in the early days, we were talking about, you know, people going online and trying to snag a spot. You might have to, you know, go stand in line for 20 minutes. And that really has evolved. Now, what's the best? I mean, you mentioned the website, but if you don't have internet connection, is the best way just to call your local clinic, even if you don't have a regular primary care doctor? How would you suggest people plug in if they just haven't gotten that far yet?
Yeah, absolutely. Call your clinic. In addition to clinics, we've got federally qualified healthcare centers as well that again can help folks regardless of insurance status. And I think that's an important thing to remember as well. So again, there's no cost to get the vaccine, and there's no copay if you have insurance. And so we've got clinics across the state that can help you with that need or other healthcare needs as well.
Do we know more than we used to know about the safety and efficacy of the different vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, continuing to evolve. You know, folks will remember that we saw a pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine here a few months ago to just make sure that all the available data was being reviewed. And then when the group of experts that looked at that data closely, you know, they said, we think it's safe to begin using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine again. And so we've had, you know, lots of data now at this point. We've seen millions of people across the world vaccinated. And so that's really given us an advantage to evaluate the safety and efficacy. And again, they are, you know, the vaccines are proven to be safe and very effective against hospitalizations and deaths from COVID in particular. You know, no vaccine is 100% effective at, you know, preventing all potential cases. But we do know that the vaccines really do work to minimize any, you know, potential health effects.
I'm looking at the map. Let's talk a little bit about community spread and tie this into what we're seeing with the Delta variant, which we know is, you know, if you've gotten your shot, you're protected against this variant in a similar way that you've been protected this whole time once you've gotten your second dose and waited to your full immunity time. Jump in here if I've said any of that wrong as well, Secretary. But there are a couple counties that have moderate spread. And, you know, for perspective, I'm looking at Pennington County right now and Meade County, Butte County. That's still not a lot of people. There's 53 active cases in Pennington County, and clearly the population is much higher than that. But it is still some moderate spread and some testing positivity of more than 6%. What are we seeing in that area of the state that gives you pause?
Well, you know, I think where we are seeing, you know, those levels of cases are correlated to where we're seeing lower vaccination rates. And so, you know, we know, again, that vaccination really is the way to end, you know, our time with this pandemic. And so when we see larger numbers of people that are not vaccinated is where we're going to see those cases. And so I don't think we're surprised by that, but it does really, you know, give us an opportunity to help encourage folks in those particular areas to, you know, again, keep an open mind, look at the data, look at the information from reliable sources. And it's never been easier to get a vaccine, and we're just encouraging people to do that because that is what will, you know, keep our cases down in the future.
Of course, we're talking to you here in July, and the big event, Sturgis, is coming up, and that is one of the areas that we're seeing low vaccination rates. Any concerns or message to the people who live or are traveling to the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally to say, hey, the gathering is going on as usual, but you have some choices to make, vaccination and then also mitigation factors. What should people know?
Yeah. Well, it is a great thing. And, you know, throughout the summer months, I think we're just seeing a lot of people, you know, coming back together with others. And it's, and for folks that are vaccinated, that can be a safe thing. For folks that are not vaccinated, you know, the recommendations are that they would take mitigation strategies like we've been talking about now for the past 18 months. And that's, you know, wearing a mask, avoiding crowded locations, physically distancing themselves from others, practicing good hand hygiene. And so those things are still really important. I would say that they're, you know, some of those things like hand hygiene are just important on a daily basis. But, you know, if people are not being vaccinated or not choosing to be vaccinated, then those other things really do come into play to help keep them safe. And we do also know that, you know, COVID spreads from, you know, through person-to-person contact for the most part. And so if you're going to be in a situation where you're around others and you're not vaccinated, it just increases your risk.
What are you seeing with the Delta variant and the unvaccinated population that you want people to understand? Is it, in fact, worse, more deadly, more dangerous?
Well, you know, we've seen so far 3 cases of the Delta variant in South Dakota, but I'll just tell you that we expect that to be, you know, lower than what's actually happening, because that just represents the cases that have actually had the viral sequencing. So we know Delta's here. We also know from data from other jurisdictions that it's more infectious than some of the other strains. And so that means it's going to spread easier. And again, we know it's going to spread among people that are unvaccinated. So, you know, with Delta coming, we're seeing in some states, primarily in the southern part of the country, where, you know, they're starting to see larger increases in cases because of the Delta variant among unvaccinated people. So, you know, we'd really like to avoid being in that situation. And the way to avoid it is to become vaccinated.
Because then we're back. I'm going to say this and correct me if I'm wrong. Are we back where we started, where hospitals can start? My question is, based on our current vaccination rate, if this variant becomes more widespread and impacts the unvaccinated population, are there enough of those people to once again put us in a situation where we are checking hospital capacity and we're trying to, you know, look at the potential death rate? How worrisome is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it is worrisome from the standpoint of it's preventable. And so, you know, we really, now that we're at the point of having vaccines that are effective, you know, we know that hospitalizations and deaths at this point are largely preventable. And, you know, we obviously don't want to see those things happen. And so, you know, we will continue, you know, we're putting out weekly updates at this point on the dashboard, but we, you know, will continue to watch those numbers very carefully. Both in terms of case numbers and hospitalizations and certainly deaths. And, you know, again, we, you know, between vaccination and getting, you know, protection from that, we, you know, what we don't know is how long protection really lasts for folks that have had COVID. And so we know there are some people out there that have experienced COVID and feel like they might be protected from that. The problem with that is we just don't know how long that protection might actually last. And so, again, the recommendation for folks that have even had COVID is to still get vaccinated for their sake. The other thing, Lori, that's really important for folks to remember is, you know, testing is still important. So if a person feels like they've got the symptoms of COVID, you know, please go get tested so that you're not unwittingly spreading it to other people and, you know, causing other folks to get sick as well.
I think that's a really important point, because a lot of people, because they're going back into public spaces, are catching a cold or they're getting some kind of funk. There's like, eh, now I feel like I'm back to normal. I know I'm vaccinated. When do you decide between like, oh, hey, there's some wildfires and it's affecting my air quality. Hey, you know, this is probably an allergy or a cold. And hey, I better get tested because I'm not really sure if this isn't what I'm experiencing. Like, what's your advice for making that distinction?
You know, I would certainly encourage people to call their provider, because that provider might know that person's, you know, history with allergies or other things that can kind of mimic the symptoms. But, you know, again, we're going to encourage people to get tested just because it's, you know, if we can rule it out, then the person knows they're not dealing with COVID. And, you know, for certain folks where maybe they do think it's something else, but it turns out to be COVID, then they can protect themselves and others.
Yeah. One of the decisions I've had, you know, most of the gatherings I go to, I sort of know who's vaccinated, who not. Because, you know, they're my friends, they're my family, they're my coworkers. We're open and talking about it. When should vaccinated people wear masks or do other mitigation strategies just to protect unvaccinated people who they might not know? I mean, is there, when you're, you know, going to a large event, if you've been vaccinated, should you mask up or should you think about it? Or is it really just for the unvaccinated population to worry about?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the guidance is really, geared towards folks that have not been vaccinated. Of course, folks that have been vaccinated that want to wear a mask or do other things are certainly, they're able to do those things. Yeah. But really where we see those other mitigation strategies being most applicable is to that unvaccinated group.
Secretary Kim Olsen-Reisden, always informative to have you on the program. We appreciate this update. Thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks, Laurie.
Let's take a moment now to head to the ranch. Tom Frederick's son, Wayne, is the seventh generation to raise cattle and horses on land that has been in their family since 1884. Frederick reflects on his family history, their connection to the land, what it means to him that they continue the ranching legacy on the Rosebud Reservation. He spoke with SDPB's Laura Rohde.
We live by our history. It's not hardly written down. We've got a written document, but we try and keep it verbal. My people have always been people of the horse from the beginning. And then my great-great-grandfather, William Cordes, came to this country in 1865, fought at the Battle of the Little Bighorn with the 7th Cavalry, lived through that. In 1884, he started this ranch here, and it encompassed about 12 miles square, and it was a horse ranch, and he raised horses and sold them to the cavalry. Kind of a two-sided thing. Married to an Indian woman who the cavalry was fighting, and he was a white man selling horses to the cavalry. A little different, but this ranch had been in our hands for all those years. It's something that there's no way to replace. I mean, if they don't do it, it's over. It's done. I did it. My uncle did it. My mother did it. My dad did it. It just, my great-grandfather did it. It's just been family. One of us has been on tribal council ever since 1935. Uncles, grandparents, me, my son, hopefully Cedar. We try and be leaders within our people structure. If you don't control your destiny, somebody else is going to do it for you, and you might not like it.
Up next, a look into the latest History 605 podcast, The Destruction of the Bison. State historian Ben Jones is with us. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Don Gagne. Irish writer Susan McKay thinks that Northern Ireland, created 100 years ago by Great Britain, might not last another 10 years. She joins us to talk Brexit, the scrambling of old divides, and talk of reunification. That story and an update on the situation in Haiti, next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by ReliaBank, personal and business banking solutions, reliable services, and a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank, a brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Facebook, the problems it's created, and the problems it's facing. My guests will be New York Times reporters Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang, authors of the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. They write, Facebook's problems have been features, not bugs. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Severance Brewing Company in Sioux Falls, providing creative craft beers that are not confined to predefined guidelines. For those longing to sever from the norm, more at severancebeer.com.
You're listening to The Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The North American bison population plummeted from an estimated 30 million animals in 1800
to fewer than 1,000 just a century later. This month, the SDPB Spotlight is focused on South Dakota history. Today, we welcome our state historian back to the program. Ben Jones is the host of the new podcast, History 605, from the South Dakota State Historical Society. And in the latest episode, Dr. Jones talks with Andrew Eisenberg. Eisenberg's book is called The Destruction of the Bison in Environmental History. And for a little context to those numbers I just gave you, here's a little bit more from that podcast. Let's take a listen.
At the beginning of this, you mentioned that maybe there were 30 million bison in the Great Plains at the most in the late 18th or early 19th century. But that number wasn't stable, that the bison population was fluctuating up and down pretty dramatically, primarily in response to drought, because when drought came, it shriveled the grasses on which the bison depended, and the bison had to kind of spread out to other kinds of areas, and that upset their patterns of reproduction. So the bison population was not static. It was moving up and down. And then when you added human pressures in the 19th century, especially when a dry period began throughout most of the plains, I mean, in patchy ways, but throughout most of the plains in the 1850s or so, that's when you really started to see a decline in the bison's numbers.
A little bit there from author Andrew Eisenberg from the History 605 podcast. Podcast host and state historian Dr. Jones, welcome. Thanks for being here with me in Sioux Falls.
Good afternoon. Thanks.
One of the interesting things that I'm really enjoying about this History 605 podcast is your approach from the historian perspective of saying, like, what's your research question? What is, help us understand that a little bit, because it's not just the story of the bison. It is a story of how did this historian or this author come to a topic with a question in mind. Help play that out for me a little bit.
Well, the way historians go about their work is to define a question. And we do that so that bias is kind of kept out as much as possible. The scientific method, you know, states a thesis or a hypothesis, and that drives a lot of the process by which they would do that. But when you talk about kind of human behaviors and a wider variety of things, and you would state a hypothesis up front, you could immediately go down, or you would narrow your research to things that comport with you, what you think you're going to find, which oftentimes would be wrong or kind of not the whole story. So by just stating a question and then trying to find all the relevant evidence and let the evidence answer your question, in the end, it really helps to let the evidence speak for itself.
Yeah. So we had a doctor on the program yesterday studying concussions, and his research question, and he referred to it as a research question, not a hypothesis, was, how many hits does a football player take? Like, we don't even know. So as we're studying concussion, our first question is, well, how often do they get hit? Mm-hmm. And then it was, well, who gets hit more, and what kind of hits are they taking? And then it was, how is that impacting them? So this whole concept of coming in with a question, what was Andrew Eisenberg's research question as he was thinking about the American bison?
Right. Well, he was a graduate student and interested in the interaction between European Americans and indigenous Americans, and wanted to do something along with that. And then as he was grading papers from undergraduates, as he was a TA, there was a comment that a student made about the drop-off in the bison population. And he thought, I wonder why that happened. And then as he goes through in the podcast, kind of did some estimates on how many there might have been. You know, what could the Great Plains in 1800 sustain? So he did some sampling and some math and extrapolated out and came up with that 28 to 30 million number. But then started doing environmental history where you try and track what's the drought patterns like, what's the rainfall, and began to see various ways in which that might impact the population of the bison.
Yeah.
Then all the other factors came into play, such as introduction of the horse, such as smallpox, such as the invention and the ability of riverboats to go upstream, such as firearms becoming available. All these things impact that, and it's just a interesting interplay of answering the question and then bringing in all the factors and then turning that into a narrative that in this case becomes 250, 300 pages, but nevertheless really relevant reading for South Dakotans.
Yeah. And for listeners, he does talk in that as well about the intentional destruction of a source of so much for the Lakota people and how that was mm-hmm. also used as really, I don't think he says the word weapon of war or destruction, but he explores that as well. And my question for you is, we read these books because we're interested in history, mm-hmm. but we also, these books speak to us today and have some sort of like, what is the thing that we need to under? When you looked at this book and this interview, what is the thing that, lesson is the wrong word, but how would you rephrase that? Sort of like the messages, messages in a bottle for us today from this book.
I think we go back to asking the question. Yeah. So what can we learn about the decline or the destruction of the bison, the near destruction of the species, and how can we formulate a question about a similar thing that we might be confronted with today? Mm. So I talk about in the first show kind of some historians' fallacies about faulty thinking and lessons of the past and so forth. The really lesson that you can, or the way you can use history then, is to think about what questions should we be asking. So in this case, if we're thinking about environmental history, what are all the factors that go into, well, California wildfires, right, mm-hmm. or wildfires throughout the West? What are all the factors that create the conditions in which the wildfires thrive? Or what might be the factors that would lead to their decline?
Yeah.
And that'd be a wide variety of things, from forest management to residential city planning to water use.
To logging roads.
Roads, right.
Drought, yeah. Seems like a really very interesting, compelling conversation right now because of the drought that we're in and some of the things we haven't understood yet that are happening as well. So History 605, the podcast, is available on most podcasting platforms. All month, we're going to talk about South Dakota history on In the Moment as part of our SDPB Spotlight coverage. You can find coverage online at sdpb.org/spotlight. Tomorrow on the program, the Dakota Political Junkies are going to get their hands dirty talking about this national debate over teaching history, and we want you to be part of this coverage by answering the question, what is something you wish you had learned in history class, or what's something that stuck with you your whole life? For me, Ben, that's Locke and Jefferson, Tom Lubeck, AP History. I will never forget. Leave us a voice message, 605-951-0740. That's 951-0740. You might hear your story on the air. Ben Jones, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
While many of us hold our national parks in high esteem, there are others who are much less impressed, and they're willing to voice their positions on social media. That is the basis of a new book. It's called Subpar Parks, America's Most Extraordinary National Parks and Their Least Impressed Visitors. The author is Amber Scher. She's a graphic designer as well, and that's really the core of this book, and Amber joins us now on the phone. Hey, Amber, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, it's, you know, a beautiful design book, but what a great laugh as well as you sort of look. Tell me a little bit about these kind of like one-star reviews and how you decided to combine them with your art and your vision and your love of national parks to sort of raise awareness and create this invitation to explore and an invitation to not take ourselves too seriously as well.
Yeah, so I'm an illustrator, and at the end of 2019, I was looking for a new side project just to kind of keep me on my toes with my illustration work, and I wanted it to focus on the outdoors because I, you know, love to be outside. I hike, backpack, kayak, you know, kind of whatever I can to stay outside. But I wanted it to be a little bit different because when I centered on drawing the parks, that's been done by a lot of different illustrators really, really well. And so I wanted something that would be a little more unique and also incorporate my hand lettering. Yeah. And I stumbled upon some one-star reviews on Reddit one day, and it just immediately clicked as what I would do for my project.
Yeah, and they're really kind of funny. The only thing bad about these lands is the entire experience, is the review of the Badlands. And what's so hilarious is, of course, people stand in front of these beautiful places like Wind Cave and say, seen a few caves? Yeah, you've seen them all. And they're not impressed. What does it say about who we are when we look at these beautiful spaces and just meh, whatever.
I know. And especially, I mean, the Badlands review is one of my favorites, yeah, just because it's so sassy. But I've lived in the Midwest I live in Raleigh, North Carolina now, but I lived in the Midwest a lot, Nebraska and Missouri, and if you consider Michigan the Midwest. And I feel like the Midwest gets such a particularly bad rap. people act like it's not very scenic, and that just couldn't be farther from the truth.
Yeah. I remember a New York Times, I think it was a New York Times magazine, a reporter who came through Mount Rushmore in like January or something and wrote about his kids, you know, complaining, are we there yet? And it was cold. I'm like, dude, it's January.
Of course.
And you brought your kids. Of course they're going to say, are we there yet? Like, what exactly did you want? And then there's other times when people are like complaining about the exact thing that is supposed to be enjoyable about these experiences. Tell us a little bit about that theme.
Yeah, so that one is particularly wild because sometimes they also complain about, I'll use Kenai Fjords in Alaska as an example. The review I used for that is that they only saw one humpback whale. And people who've been there, you know, would message me and tell me how that's like the height of an experience there. Yeah. I can't, like, their expectations were just totally wrong because that's something most people would like kind of kill to see while they're there. And they were like, well, I only saw one, so meh.
Yeah, meh. Yeah, I saw a mountain lion once in the Black Hills, and my friend Kevin has lived there this whole life, I think, mostly. And he said, I've never seen a mountain lion. That was a big deal. I'm like, oh, I was just crossing the road. You know, like, I was like, ooh, look, a mountain lion. I had no idea that I had a lifetime experience there. A lot of these are just, I want in our remaining time to talk a little bit about, you also are tongue-in-cheek with the reviews, also really great art projects, some merchandise, and then, hey, go pay attention to how you engage in your national parks and take care of them. So this is a conservation book and a celebration of the parks as well. Just in 15 seconds or so, talk about that if you would.
Yeah, so I really wanted to use the book as a platform to just kind of help people know how to make the most of their time in the parks and learn to really appreciate these spaces, because I think a lot of the reviews come from people not being prepared and thus not having the correct expectation.
Right. Right. It's called Subpar Parks, America's Most Extraordinary National Parks and Their Least Impressed Visitors. The book's available today. And this evening, author Amber Scher will take part in a virtual launch event that's 7 Central, 6 Mountain. Details for that at AmberScherDesign.com and Eventbrite.com. And I started following Amber on Instagram, and that is a good time as well. Amber, thanks so much for being here with us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.